Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans. Today, I will be talking with Jonathan White. Jonathan is an active marine conservationist, sailor, surfer, and the author of a new book called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. My first interview with Jonathan aired the week of February the 15th. We had a great conversation, but we just barely scratched the surface of the great mystery of the tides. If you missed that program, look for it on the KPTZ website. That's kptz.org. Go to the podcast page, search for Nature Now Programs, and look for the February 15th program. Today, we'll chat further about the rhythms and pulses and patterns that flow across the world's oceans. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, here's a small hint. From fall through spring, look for these critters in wide open grasslands, marshes, or fields. Towards the end of the show, I'll share the source of this mystery sound. But now let's look at some observation and news from around our area. And Charlie Fleischman, our wonderful sound engineer, will help me share this week's observations and news.
Last week, the Natural History Society sponsored a day hike along the Hansville Greenway out to the lighthouse at Point No Point. It was a great, almost spring hike. Beautiful flora and fauna, frog eggs, a beaver lodge, fascinating mushrooms and lots of birds, including trumpeter swans, scrub jays, a common loon, green-winged teal, buffleheads, a Buick's wren, and red-necked grebes.
And last weekend, while waiting for the ferry to leave the Edmonds dock, I heard a ruckus of gulls on the forward part of the car deck. Getting out to investigate, I observed several glaucous-winged gulls bickering over possession of a reddish rockfish, and it was about 8 inches long, and it was very, very spiny. This went on for several minutes, with the fish changing owners numerous times. Most of the gulls were adults, with their white heads and bellies and their silvery-gray backs and wings, but there was also a heavily streaked, light grayish-brown first-year juvenile. After some unsuccessful scrabbling, trying to get the fish, the juvenile hunkered down. He thrust his head forward and slightly upward towards the adult currently in possession of the fish, and the juvenile begged with this mewing sound. The adult dropped the fish in front of the juvenile, who then promptly oriented the fish with the head pointed into the gull's mouth, spines facing backward, of course, and just gulped down the whole thing. It was fascinating to watch.
On a walk out near Port Ludlow, Wendy Feltham noted her first palmate coltsfoot of the year. The coltsfoot is a plant. The tallest were about 4 inches tall, and water parsley were thriving in a small shady pond fed by tiny streams. She even spotted a rough-skinned newt.
And while not exactly an observation, I do have something else I want to share. Many listeners know that we here at Nature Now rely heavily on the Cornell University Ornithology Laboratory website for information about birds and especially for recordings of many of our avian mystery sounds. The website is called All About Birds. I was wandering around the website a few days ago and discovered their Birdcast. It's a section on regional bird migration forecasts. I encourage you to go there and check it out for species on the move in our area. Well, my guest today is Jonathan White. Jonathan is the author of a recently published book called Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Jonathan lives on Orcas Island, but today we're talking to him by phone because he's on a book tour in San Francisco. Just last month, Jonathan gave a fascinating talk about his book to an absolutely overflow crowd at the Pacific Northwest Maritime Center. I was there, I said, on the floor. Well, I'm so glad we've got Jonathan back today. As I mentioned last time we talked mostly about the gravitational ideas and how that changed how we think about the tides and how it can explain sort of the basic occurrence of two highs and two lows per day. Today, we're going to go deeper and we're going to talk about the concept of resonance and how that shapes the tides. Jonathan, when we think about resonance, sometimes we could think of the warm sound of a cello compared to the higher thrill of the violin. And I'm thinking also about Swedish folk musicians on the nickel harpa or the hardanger fiddle, where you've got strings that are bowed directly, and then you've got sympathetic strings that just resonate. They're not bowed, they just resonate and produce really rich sounds. But when we talk about tides, what do you mean by the concept of resonance?
It's unusual in that way, and it was certainly a surprise to me as I got into the research for this book, but very, very exciting thing to learn that just like you described with musical instruments and various other things, it's actually resonance is a very common experience in our life. When you pluck a guitar string, the body of the guitar resonates with that string or that note and amplifies it, right? We know that experience in a bathtub, even when it's full of water and we move back and forth with our body. If we move just the right kind of frequency, the bathtub water resonates with our movement and it swells, right?
Yeah, and you can get great waves.
Just the right rhythm, the water will actually jump up out of the bathtub. So actually a fairly common experience. And how that works with the tide is that, like, for example, if we take the analogy of the guitar and plucking the guitar string and the body of the guitar resonating with that string, and you blow that analogy up to the size of the solar system, the plucking of the string or the various relationships between the Earth, Moon, and Sun, and you could call those notes. The body of the guitar is the ocean basins of the world that either resonate with certain notes or not.
Okay, you're stretching my mind a bit here. I'm having a bit of a problem sort of making the leap from the physical, say, plucking of the guitar strings to the notion that I think I heard you say essentially everything in our universe has the same sort of pluck. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, let's try another analogy that may work a little bit better, and that would be singing in the shower stall. And, of course, we all do that, or we've done it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on there is the shower stall has what they call a natural tendency to vibrate when it's awakened by the right note, right? So we have that experience where we're singing in the shower. We might be singing a D or an A or an F, and then suddenly we hit a C, let's just say. The shower stall resonates with that note. And suddenly that note is rich and full and exaggerated, and we feel like a genius. We feel like maybe we
missed
our calling
because
we're a great singer. So that shower stall is resonating with that note, that particular note. And resonance, it really means when something vibrates in response to something else. That's its essential meaning. So the shower stall is resonating with that particular note. If you, again, loft that into the size of the solar system, and we think, of course, as gravity as a constant thing, and it is, but in order to study this, to understand it, we freeze certain relationships of the Earth, Moon, and Sun that have some sort of gravitational effect on the tide. So in other words, full moon, let's just freeze that. And they're all different sizes, just like shower stalls are different sizes. And each one of the ocean basins has a different tendency to vibrate. So one basin will respond to a particular note from the heavens, and another basin might respond to a different note. And some of the basins won't respond to a note at all. So that's really how it works. And there are actually many, many, many basins. For example, when we look out on the Pacific, we see or we think of one basin. But within the Pacific, there are many basins that are defined by the topography of the bottom, the depth, even the water temperature and salinity. And that all gives that particular basin a very special characteristic to resonate with a certain note from the heavens.
Let me try to paraphrase that for just a minute. We're thinking of the oceans as sets of basins. These basins have sort of a resonant frequency or a natural tendency to vibrate at a particular frequency. And that, of course, the basins, because of their size and topography and configuration and wind and so on, are going to vibrate differently.
That's right.
Is that how we can start to understand why the tides behave differently in different parts of the world? I mean, we have diurnal tides here on the Pacific coast and then around the Salish Sea. That's, we have mostly a higher high and a lower low and then two in between. The Mediterranean, if I'm remembering correctly, only has one tide a day. And I know you've mentioned that there are other places that have many more tides a day. Didn't you mention someplace having like six tides a day?
There's a place in Ireland that has six tides a day.
The way I'm beginning to understand this is that the differences in the natural frequency of vibration of the different basins then overlap the sort of standard frozen in time gravitational pulls we talked about last time.
Yes. One of the interesting things that I discovered in my research on the subject is that the tide is a lot of different things. Some of those things seem to be paradoxical, but in order to really understand it, you kind of have to hold all these things in your mind at once. For example, the tide is a wave that travels around the world at 450 miles per hour, but it's also resonance. So, and the, both those things can exist at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's initially that's kind of hard to get a grip on, but that is the way this works. And in order for scientists to really understand this, they've had to dumb it down. So again, we know gravitation is a constant thing. We know that the Earth, Moon, and Sun are constantly moving and they're constantly changing their relationships. So it's a little bit of a stretch, yet it makes good practical sense in the study of tides to freeze those relationships. And again, it's a little bit artificial, but that's the only way, even during the scientific revolution, that's what they did. And that's how they decided the only way that they could really break this apart to unpack it and understand it is freeze these relationships. And they've actually given them names, and there's over 400 of them that have been identified now as having some tide signature on Earth. And so I am stretching that a little bit by calling those notes, but it's not that much of a stretch. So again, all the ocean basins of the world, and there are really thousands of them, respond to notes differently because of their own inherent characteristic mm-hmm. to vibrate.
So it helps us kind of grasp the complexity of the tides to think about the vibration of these different basins. So I'm now curious. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, of course, that we tend to think of the Pacific as one big basin, and yet we think about it a little more and we know it's not. There are sub-basins, there's the continental shelf. What happens when sort of one basin comes up against another basin, like the Salish Sea and the Pacific Ocean, or the Mediterranean and the Atlantic Ocean through the Straits of Gibraltar? What happens in those places?
There is a communication between them. I guess that's another layer of complexity in all this, is that all the basins are touching one another. One of the analogies that one of the oceanographers I interviewed in the Bay of Fundy gave me, he said, Jonathan, imagine a table, a long flat like a coffee table, and it's full of pans. And each pan is a different size, some really shallow, some wide, some deep. Each of those pans is filled with some water. Again, so a little water in some and a lot of water in another. And now imagine that you start kicking the table's leg at some kind of a rhythm. Maybe it's one every second,
mm-hmm.
a heavy beat like that. He said, now look at those pans, and you can imagine that some of those pans would respond to that kicking very excitedly, and some of the pans would not. So that's another way to describe this resonance. The kicking is a beat from the heavens, right? It's the sun overhead every day at a 24-hour cycle. We don't think of that sometimes as a rhythm, but it's a long rhythm. Every 24 mm-hmm. hours, we get a beat from the sun. So then he said, all of those pans are touching one another. So if one pan is vibrating, that vibration is going to communicate to the next. Yeah, they are all connected. the Pacific, to the Atlantic, to the Indian.
Another question is, I assume this happens, but can the sort of resonating personalities of these different ocean basins change over time?
Yes. That ties into sea level rise, because as the sea level changes, and again, it's changed a lot over geological time, it changes the shape of the basins, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the depth of the water changes. Now the vibrating frequency of those basins changes, so it responds mm-hmm. differently to the notes from the heavens.
Earthquakes or slides down the continental shelf, I'm sure, all change the topography. So that makes sense.
And so does human development and trenching and so forth. We've already seen that happening over in Europe, where in some cases where they've done a lot of coastal development and changing the coastline, they've actually increased the resonance in some cases and decreased it in others. A funny story about this is that the Bay of Fundy is a highly resonant basin. It shares the title for the largest tide in the world at 64.6 feet. When they, during the 70s, during the oil crisis, they were considering putting a tide barrage across the Bay of Fundy, which is basically a causeway all the way across the bay to capture the water and then create tide energy or electricity with the large tides there. And there was, of course, a lot of controversy about it. But the thing that finally made them not do it to stop that development was that one scientist, Chris Garrett, could prove to them that if they put that barrage across the Bay of Fundy, it would change the resonant quality of the bay such that the large tides that were in the Bay of Fundy would stop and that same large tide would be pushed down to Boston. And they made a joke about it, of course, saying, oh, well, okay, well, if we did that, we have a built-in market for our electricity because they're going to need a lot of pumps to pump out their basements.
Right. Changing the subject just a bit, I'm thinking now about predicting tides and the science of predicting tides. How do scientists not only combine the notions of the gravitational pulls, but resonance to sort of generate tide tables?
Ties in very well, because really resonance is our modern way of looking at and predicting tides. And in the scientific terms, it's called harmonic analysis. And what I've been calling notes from the heavens have tide constituents. And like I said, there are over 400 of these identified as having some sort of tide signature. So today, NOAA, who makes our tide charts, they take a certain number of those constituents and they factor them in and they come up with the tide tables based on the harmonic analysis for each basin. And you could say that that's a resonant response to each basin. Typically, they use about 35 of these constituents to come up with the tide tables for the United States. But there are places where they need more constituents because they need a more refined chart, and places where they need less. Like, for example, up in the Cook Inlet in Alaska, where they've got a lot of oil traffic and of rocks and a lot of tide, they use 80 constituents because they need it that
they need a bit more information. Yeah.
Places like the Gulf down on the Louisiana coast where there isn't much tide, they might use 10. Italy uses about 6.
As has happened the last time, Jonathan, we could talk for a really long time about this. I know I want you to read something from your book. So you said you had a selection about resonance.
From the end of the chapter that I call Big Tides and Resonance in the book. Resonance is everywhere, even in unexpected places. Kim Bostwick and the science team from Cornell University learned that a male club-winged manakin, a rare South American bird, uses resonance to attract a mate. The sparrow-sized manakin has 9 inner wing feathers, the innermost of which have large hollow shafts. When rubbed together at the right frequency, these innermost feathers excite all 9 feathers to resonate in unison, wooing females with a sustained violin-like note close to a F sharp. Oceans, like swings and feathers, have inherent rhythms that can be excited by a resonant push from the celestial world. This excitation introduces a new dimension to our thinking about tides. Where we once thought the sun and moon pushed and pulled the oceans around the planet, we now understand that it's a partnership. The sun and moon call out, as it were, and the oceans call back, sometimes with enthusiasm and sometimes with an apparent lack of interest. Like a mother who singles out her child's voice among the many voices in the playground, some ocean basins are so finely tuned to one astronomical signal that they don't hear the others.
That's lovely, and your style is so gorgeous. You will come back, and we've talked about spending a little bit of time talking about some of the amazing features of tides, like tidal bores and some of the mythology and beliefs around what caused the tides. And there's lots of other things to talk about. Jonathan will be back Wednesday, April the 12th, and we'll have another conversation. So thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Nan. I so appreciate being on your show.
Now let's go to that mystery sound. Let's hear that again. That was the alarm call of the Northern Harrier, formerly known as a marsh hawk. Northern Harriers are slim, long-tailed hawks that hold their wings in a V-shape while gliding low over marshes and grasslands, hunting for small mammals, birds, and even amphibians. At close range, the face of a Northern Harrier looks rather owl-like. And unlike other hawks, it relies heavily on sound as well as vision to detect prey. It's aided by that facial disc, which, as in owls, is thought to help with the location of faint sounds, allowing the harrier to detect prey concealed in the vegetation. One other curious thing about the Northern Harrier is that the males and females are actually quite different from each other. The male is smaller than the female and is sometimes called a gray ghost hawk due to its overall pale coloration, gray above, white below. The females are bigger, and they're brown with dark stripes on the belly and on the tail. On the calendar for this upcoming week, on the evening of March 17th, come out to the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Hall for a St. Patrick's Day screening of Reaching Blue, a film about climate change in the Salish Sea. The Quimper Unitarian Fellowship, as well as Jefferson Land Trust and the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and a number of other businesses are sponsoring this event. I suggest you check the website of either the Land Trust or the Marine Science Center for more details.
On Saturday, March 18th, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is hosting a field trip along the Dungeness Spit, focusing on late winter shorebirds, gulls, and waterfowl. Trip leader Bob Bokelhide will present an experiential lesson on just what are Olympic gulls. Bob says to bring your stale bread. Also on Saturday, March 18th, you could join the Admiralty Audubon Society for a field trip to a number of sites in South Jefferson County, including the Tarbu Valley, Quilcene Bay, and the Dosiwallop State Park.
Then on Saturday morning, March the 19th, join those good folks at Admiralty Audubon for a work party at the Cotai Lagoon to remove invasive species and just do a little spring cleaning. Details for both activities are available on the Admiralty Audubon website.
Tuesday, March 21st, the monthly meeting of the Native Plant Society includes a talk by David Allen, an Olympic National Park botanist, and Matt Albright, Native Plant Nursery Manager. David will be sharing information on restoring plant communities in the Elwha River watershed.
That's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ, that's 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Riptide, performed by Laura Veers.
Riptide pulls me out into the open sea. My toes dangle for a place to stand and be. Oh, starry night, come and chart a course, or send me a boat with an anchor set. I'll pull myself ashore. Left with essence of the moon and stars and night, there's no other route. I cannot take self to flight. I'll float here with the shrimp and brine, and on my cheeks and hair the salt will